Lecture 2, The Hundred Years' War and the Church in Crisis.
In our last lecture, we were talking about the crisis of the 14th century, which really provides a transition between the Middle Ages, which pretty much comes to an end in the 14th century, and the coming of the Renaissance, a period of rebirth. And in the last lecture, we talked about the terrible demographic disaster of the plague, and we talked about social and economic crisis, and we just had gotten into talking about political turmoil. And I told you a lot about peasant revolts and noble civil wars. And the last aspect we need to cover with respect to that is the long and complicated, costly international wars that were fought during the period, primarily the Hundred Years' War, which was fought between 1337 and 1453. I mentioned at the end of the last lecture that one of the most important reasons that these long and costly wars had such an impact on Europe during the 14th century was the fact that they essentially drove a wedge between the king and nobles. And this was important because throughout the entire Middle Ages, the king and his biggest nobles had been essentially partners in rule and governing the country. Because many of these nobles were almost as big and rich and powerful as the king himself, and the king really couldn't rule the country without their cooperation and goodwill. Unfortunately, during the 14th century, the cost of warfare with the use of mercenaries and firearms and things that we talked about last time produced financial demands by the king upon the nobles, which really turned these two former partners into adversaries. And you start to see nobles opposing the king a whole lot more in the 14th century. And the whole structure of medieval monarchy just starts to break down because kings really can't govern their countries without the help of these powerful men. And in fact, wars like the Hundred Years' War make both England and France, the two principal combatants, almost ungovernable. The king just really can't effectively rule his country anymore without the help of the nobles. So it's important to take a look at what the Hundred Years' War was all about. I'm not going to go through and fight the whole war battle for battle, but we'll take a look at, first of all, the causes of the war and a few of the highlights of the war, and then the consequences of the war and its effect on the 14th century. So the Hundred Years' War really was the worst of all these long and complex international wars, and it was fought over succession to the French throne. Now, last time I mentioned that in many cases in the 14th century, kings would die without male heir, direct male heir, and that's exactly what happened in the case of France in 1328 when the king, Charles IV, died in Paris without any direct male heir. And that was the end of the Capetian dynasty, which had ruled France since 987. And since 987, each one had had a son, a direct male heir, so there never really had been a problem, but now there was a problem. Charles was dead, and there was no direct male heir. So the French nobles start to look down the family tree to find out, you know, who would be the next in line to be king, and they come to a disturbing conclusion, which is that there are two people who are essentially equally closely related to the old king, and there are other complicating factors as well. One of the people is Philip of Valois, who's a relatively unknown French noble, but you know has a legitimate stake to the throne, and that was fine. The other candidate, though, was more troubling because he was King Edward III of England, the King of England. And, you know, automatically it's going to be a problem for the French nobles if the King of England becomes their king, but he does have a legitimate stake, or at least so it appeared. Complicating this factor, this situation, was the fact that while Philip's relationship was obviously very clear and direct, Edward's relationship to the old king was through a female. Edward was the son of Charles, the dead king's sister. Well, that's complicating because the laws in the two countries hold different things with regard to female inheritance. English law recognizes female inheritance, and therefore you can come to the throne of England if your claim goes through a female. That's not really a problem because females can inherit in England. So, and England, of course, later on had queens. Under French law, however, there was no recognition of female inheritance. And so the issue about whether Edward was really legally related through this female was controversial to the French nobles. Eventually, the French nobles called together a big meeting, and they decided that they really thought Edward's claim was not as strong, and besides that, they didn't want the King of England as their king, and therefore they recognized Philip as the next king of France. At first, that wasn't a problem with Edward. He said, okay, they've made their decision, I can accept that. But there were other complicating factors that pushed the situation along, one of which came from the area known as Flanders. Now, Flanders is what is present-day Belgium. And in the late Middle Ages, Flanders was an extremely urbanized area. It had a lot of big cities, industrial cities, Antwerp, Bruges, Brussels, Tournai, and Ypres. Most of these cities were deeply involved in the woolen cloth industry. And they bought their raw wool to make the woolen cloth from English wool merchants because England was a big producer of raw wool. Flanders had been for many centuries ruled by France because the Count of Flanders was a vassal of the King of France. Unfortunately, most people in Flanders didn't like being ruled by France because they weren't French. They were Flemish. They didn't speak French. They spoke a version of what is today Dutch. And especially in the big industrial towns, they didn't take at all happily to being ruled by France. And on several occasions in the past, they'd actually thrown the Count out and declared their independence, and the French had to come in and reconquer them. So this area had a long history of turmoil and resistance to French rule. When the issue of the French throne came up, French succession came up, woolen merchants in the Flemish towns essentially told the English, we want the King of England to press his claim on the throne because we'd rather be ruled by the King of England as King of France than Philip, you know, a more traditional French ruler. This made Edward stop and think because the Flemish woolen merchants further said, if you don't press your claim on the throne, we might just not buy your raw wool anymore. And if the Flemish towns don't buy English raw wool, that's just going to worsen the economic depression in England. And we've seen, you know, the 14th century was a period of tremendous economic depression all over. So Edward was kind of pushed on the way to claiming the throne and pushing his case by what was said in the Flemish towns. But the whole thing was capped off by a tremendous blunder by Philip, who by now has been crowned as the new French king. In 1337, he took this opportunity to invade English lands in France. Now, there had been substantial English land holdings in France ever since the Norman invasion of 1066. And throughout most of the High Middle Ages, kings of England had spent a great deal of time in France defending English lands, such as Aquitaine, against French invasions and French threats. So this was nothing particularly new, but it was a very bad point in time for Philip to do this because his invasion of English lands in France tipped the balance, and Edward decides he will press his claim. And he sends a message, you know, he demands the throne, and this is what starts off the Hundred Years' War. The French, of course, say we've already crowned a king, and so the English have to invade France, which they do in 1337. The war lasts 100 years, although it's not 100 years of continuous fighting. There are several peace treaties or truces in the meantime and lulls, but it drags on and on through a couple of different kings on England's side and several different kings on the French side. And there are a number of important battles in it, which we don't really have time to go through all, but I'll talk about a couple of them. And there are also a number of important technological innovations that come up in the war. Probably the first important battle was the Battle of Sluys, which was a naval battle fought off the coast just at the very beginning of the war, in which the English fleet essentially destroyed the French fleet. And the reason this was important is because it assured that the war was going to be fought in France, that the Hundred Years' War, the battleground would be France, and France would be the country directly torn up by all the fighting. So that was important. There were other important battles too. Crecy in 1346, Poitiers in 1356, the next century, Agincourt in 1415. And the interesting thing about these battles is that the English win almost all these battles. And they do it because they have what you might call a secret weapon. And that secret weapon is the English longbow. Now, we know that bows and arrows have been used in combat since ancient days. You know, so there's nothing new about the bow and arrow. But the English longbow was an exceptionally long bow with a very tight drawstring on it. And the important thing about it was that you could get tremendous force behind an arrow with this huge bow length and taut drawstring. And the arrow from a longbow could penetrate chainmail armor. So this is going to cause trouble for knights, and in fact, the French army still employs knights to some extent in its first line of attack. Even more important, though, the longbow has a big advantage over the main French infantry weapon, the crossbow. The crossbow also can penetrate chainmail armor. It fires a short, stubby bolt, not a long arrow. But the thing about the crossbow is it's big and heavy, hard to operate, and it takes a long time to reload it. It's a short, stubby cross with, again, a very taut drawstring. But to reload the crossbow, you actually have to put it down on the ground and crank a crank that will bring back the wire before you can put the bolt in. And what that means is it takes a lot longer to reload a crossbow than it does a longbow. So the rate of English fire from the longbow was many times faster than the rate of French fire from the crossbow. And so that meant in the initial charges in these battles, the English had essentially, you know, much more firepower than the French had. And nevertheless, French knights continued to charge right into the face of the longbows, and the longbows cut them down. Every single time at Crecy, at Poitiers, even in Agincourt, the same thing happens over and over again. And sometimes the French cavalry would even charge in unfavorable conditions, like across marshy ground or when they weren't particularly well organized. And so it was really a disaster for the French military machine. At the Battle of Crecy, it was estimated that a whole generation of French nobility was wiped out as the nobles were, you know, just decimated by the longbow. So the English win almost all the important battles in this war. Nevertheless, the French hold on. By the time we get to the 15th century and drawing towards the end of the war, though, the French are just barely holding on. As a matter of fact, the King of France is holed up in the city of Orléans, and he doesn't control hardly any of the country outside Orléans. He's there under siege, essentially waiting to be defeated. And at that point, one of the really interesting things in history happens, and that's Joan of Arc. A French peasant girl shows up at the gates of Orléans and asks to speak to the king. Of course, she's turned down several times, but after repeated requests, she's allowed in, and she tells the French king that she has been sent on a mission from God to lead French forces to break the siege of Orléans, to recapture France, and particularly to take the King of France to the city of Reims so he can be crowned officially, which he never had been crowned. This particular French king had never officially been crowned. And Joan's argument was that the King of France was God's favorite king. He wants to see the King of France win. He wants to see the King of France crowned properly. And so she's there to do the job. Well, the King of France didn't have much option at this point, so he decided to try it. He had his assistants cut her hair. He gave her a suit of armor, also gave her a number of military advisors who could help her out with strategy, and put her in charge of the French armies. They then broke the siege of Orléans and drove the English back to the English Channel. Now, in many ways, militarily, it was a miracle. But the French forces were rallied by Joan of Arc and went from success to success. Did she have some kind? Was she on a mission from God? Did she have special powers? I mean, at the time, people thought probably yes. More recent historians think it was the contributions of her military advisors who gave her good advice and helped her rally and inspire the forces. But there's no doubt that she did rally and inspire the forces and bring the French to victory. At the end of the war, she was captured by the allies of the English, the Burgundians, turned over to the English, and they thought she had special powers because they burnt her at the stake as a witch. And as she was burning at the stake, one of the English soldiers turned to another and said, "I think we've just burnt a saint." And so the Hundred Years' War came to an end. In some ways, you could say the French won. They drove the English out, and they didn't let the English claim their throne. But in other ways, nobody was a winner. Both countries' treasuries are drained. Both kings are left almost unable to govern their countries. Civil wars break out in both countries afterwards, and it's really a major political disaster. Which brings us to the last disaster of the 14th century, the disaster within the church, which was equally upsetting to everybody in Europe. Since the late 13th century, the crown of France had a lot of influence over the papacy. And in 1305, a new pope was elected who was French, Clement V. Clement V decides that he will move the headquarters of the papacy from Rome to the southern French city of Avignon, which was a papal city, but it was in France and very much, of course, influenced by the French crown. This move from Rome to Avignon is known as the Babylonian captivity, and the pope resides in Avignon in this Babylonian captivity from 1305 to 1378. Why did he move the papacy? He said he moved it because law and order had broken down in Rome to the point where he couldn't run the church effectively from Rome anymore. But other historians guess that it was probably the king of France who pressured him into making this move. In any event, when he moves to Avignon, it really changes the whole complexion of the church. And one of the biggest problems is that when the pope moved to Avignon, he lost the revenues from the papal states. Now, the papal states are a little strip of territory running through the center of Italy from Rome in the south to Ravenna in the north, controlled by the pope. These are his personally controlled territories. And he took tax monies and revenues from these tiny states and helped use those revenues to run the church. In Avignon, he obviously doesn't have access to these revenues because all the papal states, once the pope is gone, declare themselves independent and then stop paying the taxes and stop giving the revenues to the church and the papacy. So that forces the pope to find money in some other way to run the church. And he has to set up a fairly elaborate bureaucracy of, you know, offices and new taxes just to get the money to run the church. Now, if you look at it from the pope's point of view, he's got to have the money to run the church, so there are only a few places he can get it. And new fees and taxes are going to be one of those. For example, he starts to exploit church appointments, in other words, charging money to appoint people to church office. He issues more indulgences than he'd issued in the past. He starts to give out dispensations for revenue. But even worse than that, the pope causes the church to start charging fees to common churchgoers for all sorts of things they never paid fees for before. So, where in the past people used to get services free from the church, now the average churchgoer, which is, you know, a peasant or a poor person, has to pay for those services. And this is just to get the money to actually operate the church. Without it, the church couldn't have continued operating. But what this does is It makes the papacy and the church look like greedy, money-grubbing, materialistic institutions only interested in getting money out of their parishioners and the faithful. And this causes a huge wave of anti-clericalism all across Europe. Common people by the masses turn against the church, believing the church is only out to make a buck and only out to make the buck off them. And, you know, to some extent that was true, but you can see what the church's problems really were. But this whole apparatus of new taxes, new fees, new charges, known as papal fiscalism, really made the church look terrible, hurt its prestige tremendously all across Europe. By 1378, Pope, by this time Gregory XI, has decided it's got to stop. That we can't continue down this road because the church is going to lose all its prestige. He decides that he's got to move the papacy back to Rome, which he does in 1378. Unfortunately, after he gets back to Rome, only a couple of months after he gets back and sets the church back up in Rome, he dies. And the cardinals have to go into session and elect a new pope, which they do. They elect an Italian cardinal who becomes Pope Urban VI. However, it turns out that Pope Urban VI wants to reform the church. A lot of the corruptions and abuses that people have complained about during the 14th century, he wants to clean up, and especially fees and money coming into the church that is being used in not the best ways. He wants to clean all that up. However, the cardinals had not realized when they elected him that he was a reformer. And especially the French cardinals didn't like at all the fact that he was a reformer because they didn't want to be reformed. They liked things pretty much the way they were. So a good portion of the cardinals, mainly French cardinals, go back into session, declare Urban's election invalid, elect a new pope, this time a French one, and then French cardinals and a French pope get up and move back to Avignon. So from 1378 to 1415, we enter a period known as the Great Schism, because the Italian pope and the Italian cardinals stay in Rome. And so now we have two popes, one in Rome, one in Avignon. In fact, we have two entire churches, two entire church organizations, one in Rome, one in Avignon. And people all over Europe have to decide which pope and church they're going to follow. Ordinary people have to decide this. Kings have to decide it. Even universities take sides. Some choose the French pope, some choose the Italian pope. You know, Europe is split right down the middle. To make things worse, each one of the rival popes excommunicates the other rival pope and all his followers, meaning everybody in Europe is excommunicated, meaning that nobody's going to go to heaven. And so you can see the situation is very, very embarrassing for the church. And the church is split right down the middle. And perhaps an even worse disaster than the Babylonian captivity. This gives rise to a movement which attempts to heal the schism, and that movement is known as the conciliar movement. And it's based on the calling of a church council, which is simply a meeting of all the major bishops in the church to decide some big issue. The lack of papal leadership in the church, or I guess you could say the overabundance of papal leadership, since we have two popes now, led a lot of cardinals to think that the only way we can cure this schism and decide who's really the true pope is to call a church council and let the council vote on it and decide who is the real pope. Even before the schism developed, though, there had been a history to conciliarism that's worth just mentioning. In the Middle Ages, some theologians had dealt with the problem, or thought about the problem, what would happen if all of a sudden the pope became insane, or became a heretic, or otherwise incompetent to rule the church? What would happen then? And a lot of people suggested, a lot of reformers suggested, that a church council would take control of the church and govern it in place of the pope who wasn't, you know, any longer able to do it. Other supporters of the conciliar movement went even further. They said, you know, a general council of all the bishops is really a better way to rule the church anytime. It's better than a pope because it can do more than a pope can do. For example, it's more democratic. It represents all the people in the church. It might be able to even reform the church better than the Pope, because the Pope is just one man, and he's subject to all sorts of pressures, and you know, people can prevent him from acting, whereas a council of many, many, many bishops would be more able to act and perhaps reform the church and do good things for the church. So this whole conciliar movement has a history, but it becomes much more influential during the period of the Great Schism. Also, the prominence of the church council during this period is a measure of how far the papacy has fallen in prestige since the Middle Ages, when the Pope was unquestionably the head of the church. Now there are a lot of people questioning whether the Pope should be head of the church, can be head of the church, and many people are answering that no. Well, the first effort by the conciliar movement to bring about a solution to the Great Schism occurred in 1409, when a general council of the church was called and convened in the city of Pisa. And this was supposed to decide which of the two popes would be the real pope. One of the drawbacks of the Council of Pisa was that it was in Italy, which meant that it was much more attended by Italian churchmen. Not so many from Northern Europe could attend because it was so far away. But it still went about its business fairly efficiently and elected a new pope, and then declared the other two popes deposed. However, the other two popes refused to resign, refused to step down, stayed in place. And so the Council of Pisa ends with now three popes, one in Pisa, one in Rome, and one in Avignon. Three church organizations, three everything. So it just makes the situation all that much more desperate. By 1414, a lot of people were starting to give up hope, but the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund said, let's have one more try at a church council. Let's call a church council and really make another effort to decide which pope is going to be the true pope. This council was held from 1414 to 1418 in the city of Constance in Switzerland, a much more centrally located place, therefore much better representation from all areas of Europe, not just Italian officials. And it starts to do its business very efficiently. It deposes all three rival popes and elects a fourth pope as the true pope, this pope named Martin V. This time, however, the council gets lucky and the other three popes resign, step down, you know, give it up, and we're left with just one pope. So the Great Schism is technically over, but the church's problems aren't over. Because when Martin was elected pope, the members of the church council forced him to agree to a situation in which the church council would be supreme ruler in the church. And the pope would be like an administrator who would carry out the council's desires. The council would meet, say, every 3 years, and in between meetings the pope would carry out its orders. But the pope really wouldn't be the head of the church anymore. The church council would be. And if Martin hadn't agreed to that, he wouldn't have been elected pope. So he did agree to it. And that's how the council ended. But after the end of the council, Martin and succeeding popes are determined to slowly but surely regain their power in the church. And the way they do this is, in fact, quite costly. They go to various kings of Europe, the powerful kings of France and Spain and other countries, and they offer these kings essentially deals. They say, Pope says to the king, we will give you control of the church in your country. You can make church appointments in your country. You can take a large portion of church taxes from the church in your country. In return, you support the Pope over the council as head of the universal church. And kings were more than willing to do this because it would give them tremendous power over church appointments and church revenues in their countries. So the deal was made. The clash, the final clash, occurs at the Council of Basel, which takes place in 1431 to 1443. There the Pope and the church council face each other down. The Pope declares he's head of the church. The council declares it's head of the church. The council gets so frustrated with the Pope, it actually deposes the Pope and appoints a new Pope, who has gone down in history as being called the anti-pope Felix V. But what the council has done is essentially recreate the schism, which it was born to heal by, you know, deposing one pope and appointing a rival pope. And this obvious reopening of all the wounds of the schism just turned everybody in Europe against the church council and caused the pope to be able to come back and take complete control over the church. And his power in the church just grows after that into the magnificent Renaissance papacy.